This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at The Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. Guantanamo, the word itself, have become one of the symbols that haunt the Bush administration's war on terror. But the prisoners, the men inside the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, are almost entirely unknown. Their lives are a mystery. Their histories are obscured by the legal and political struggle that dominates the front pages of newspapers around the world. Early last year, a slow trickle of releases from Guantanamo became a flood as the population there dwindled to about 270. McClatchy newspapers realized there was now an opportunity to find out who these men were, what happened, and how it changed them. Reporters set out to track down as many of the former detainees as they could. What they found was, in many cases, men who'd started out with no thought of jihad, who learned to hate America inside America's prisons. Reporters Tom Lasseter and Matthew Schofield traveled to 11 countries to interview 66 former detainees, a story that was no small challenge to report or to edit. Matthew Schofield and McClatchy foreign editor Roy Gutman join us in just a moment to tell us how they got that story. Later in the hour, the painful price of China's modernization in a trip up the Yangtze. But first, getting to know the detainees and how they got that story. If you have questions about how McClatchy tracked down these men, what they asked them once they found them, and how they checked on what they were told, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Roy Gutman is with us here at the museum. He's McClatchy's foreign editor, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil. Nice to be here.
And Matthew Schofield is also with us. He was McClatchy's European bureau chief. He's now deputy national editor of the Kansas City Star. He spoke with 13 of the 66 detainees, and he's now on a much-needed vacation at his family home in Pittsburgh at member station WDUQ. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And Matthew, tell us a little bit. Who was the first detainee you spoke with, and how did you find him?
The first detainee I talked with would have been Kasim Abubakar in Tirana, Albania. And I found him, and we had a list of all the detainees, and we were checking through to see who had been released. And I noticed that there were, at the time, there were six of them in Albania. I figured, well, that's a nice group. So I went down to talk to them. He was a Uyghur, a Chinese Muslim. And how he ended up in Albania seemed an interesting story.
Did he speak, let me put it this way, do you speak Uyghur?
I do not speak Uyghur, and he did not speak English. He also did not speak Albanian, which made it a little bit more difficult to
find
live
an interpreter
in
on that, yeah.
Yeah, we had an interpreter, but we couldn't find an interpreter who spoke Uyghur and English, or even, what we had to do was, Abu also spoke some Arabic. He was easier, but he had four friends with him, or four Uyghurs with him. We would sit around a table. We would have to get a large table. We tried to do this in their apartments, and they weren't big enough, so we had to go to restaurants, and we'd take a back room and sit around a table and talk from English to Albanian, Albanian to Arabic, Arabic to Uyghur. Abubakar had taught himself Arabic while in Guantanamo. He had spent 6 months without being able to speak to anyone, and he tried to learn English, and the guards didn't like the idea of him understanding what they were saying, he said. So he just taught himself Arabic using a Turkmen Arabic Quran. So we would do this little game of telephone around the table coming back. It took about 10 hours per interview.
And you found out some extraordinary things, and not just from him, but from the other detainees that you spoke with, including the fact that, at least according to what they say, they were the wrong guys, most of them. They were not people involved in the Taliban or al-Qaeda, that they were ratted on by somebody else who wanted to get them out of the way, or there was false information or something like that, and found themselves in this horrendous situation, first at most of them at Bagram Airfield, the prison there in Afghanistan, and then all the way to Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, absolutely. And in some of the cases, it seemed rather outrageous. There's a former doctor. My memory just skipped. An Algerian doctor who had ended up in Pakistan. He was living in a UN refugee camp. He was working for the Red Crescent at the time, teaching English in a local school. he'd been working for the UN as a doctor for 10, 12 years before that. Agents, the Pakistani military, stopped by his house on one afternoon, 6 months after 9/11, looking for someone else. They didn't find him there. They came back an hour, 15 minutes later, and said, well, could we look through your house? Since this person, could we just search your house? He said, that'd be fine. And they came back after the search had turned up nothing and said, well, would you come down and talk to us? And he agreed, thinking, well, what the heck? He next saw his family. Well, he hasn't seen his family yet. That was in I think that was 2002, but it might have been late 2001. And this is a doctor, and he had UN. He was punching a clock, a time clock, every day with the United Nations.
And did he ever find out why he was there?
No. There were allegations that he had been a member of Algerian terrorist organizations. His argument against this was that these Algerian terrorist organizations had been formed after 5 years after he'd left Algeria. But no, he never really had an understanding of why they wanted him, what they were doing with him.
Hmm. Roy Gutman, here at the museum, we should point out, first of all, that much of the reporting on the story was done by Tom Lasseter, who's on vacation as well, though he's on vacation in the Adriatic Sea, so unable to be with us today. But I wanted to ask you a question about, once you started this story, some of the challenges in terms of editing this material as it comes back to you.
Well, the biggest challenge was really who could we get to, and what could we learn from them? The reporters in the field are very competent guys, but to get people to actually tell you their life story when they've been traumatized, abused, when they're bitter, when they and then they may even have something to conceal, is extremely tough, and you have to give it a lot of time, and you have to really go slowly almost. So what we did was we started off by organizing a questionnaire. It was about 20 or 30 points. We wanted to look for mistreatment along the way. We wanted to look for the circumstances of arrest. We wanted to look for the circumstances in which they were released. And then once we got those 20 points filled out, then I asked the reporters to go back and try to find authorities who could corroborate as much of this as possible. So that was just the reporting alone was an immense chore. When the profiles started coming in, I was reading them one after another, and I decided they didn't have enough corroboration in them, so I went back to the reporters again. Then I think it was at least 50 interviews in when I talked to Tom Lasseter, who was by that point the principal reporter, and I said, sit down, please, now, and write up an outline of what you think you have. And we did this exercise about every 6 weeks or so. And he came up with some themes by reading through the profiles that he was drafting, in fact, that emerged as the articles in the series. And then, of course, the big problem became the quantity of material we had was overwhelming. It really is the length of a book.
Here's an email question from David that I think a lot of people would worry about. How do you know these men are telling the truth since you have no way to corroborate their stories and Al-Qaeda trains its operatives to lie about abuse and about their innocence? And it's not even Al-Qaeda. You can go to any prison in the United States and find you ask people there if they committed the crimes that they're in prison for, and very few of them will say yes.
Well, we were very aware of this, and that made me all the warier as we were proceeding, that we didn't want to be presenting things to the public that we ourselves did not trust or were not confident about. And yet you can't check everything out. But I had the principle that if we can check out two or three points of any one story with the authorities or with other detainees or just somehow put the story together, that might give us enough to go on that we could at least tell the public we trust this part of the story. Well, the question basically is, if these were Al-Qaeda men, weren't they lying? The interesting thing that we found was that very few of a number of those that we found had actually gone through an Al-Qaeda training camp, but an enormous number of the 66 that we interviewed actually, maybe at least two-thirds, were either from Pakistan or from Afghanistan, and their connection with Al-Qaeda was tangential at best. They were maybe in the battlefield during the internal conflict of the 1990s, fighting against the United Front, which was just another side in the war, but they were never part of al-Qaeda, and they had no training in al-Qaeda. And that's the so therefore, the al-Qaeda training manual does not apply. And then you have the interesting question, well, who are these guys? How did they get scooped up? And what's their story? Well, and how do you corroborate their story? Because they also could be misleading you. In every case, our reporters went to the local authorities. It might have been the local police, might have been the local military intelligence, it might have been the National Human Rights Commission or others. And we used those people in every case to verify. And in most cases, and not every case, it didn't work. Some cases, the authorities were divided. But in quite a number of cases, they backed up the stories.
Matthew Schofield, let me ask you, was there any case where you thought you were being lied to?
There was no case in which I was able to put forth any evidence that they were being lied to. I mean, I think one of the central things we're looking at is because we're looking at people who were released from Guantanamo, U.S. officials had made a decision at the very least they've made a decision not to hold these people anymore. So these were not seen as imminent threats to American security at any level. This had been a decision made by the people who had taken them. What we found in talking to officials, and I was dealing with European detainees, people. So these are people who had been in the region after coming from Europe. So perhaps a bit less along the lines of what Roy was talking about earlier with the Pakistanis and the Afghans.
Yeah.
In Germany, for instance, Murat Karnauz, there is no suspicion at any level of him being involved in terrorism from any German officials. In the UK, you have people who've been watching some of the guys who've been released, but they're not being rearrested. They're not being held in any for any particular. And members of Parliament are actually quite upset with the way the United States has treated them.
We're talking.
So I don't really find that. I didn't find anything along those lines.
We're talking with McClatchy's foreign editor Roy Guttman and with reporter Matt Schofield about their project on Guantanamo detainees, and we're going to take your calls about how they got that story at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back with more in just a moment. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. When Guantanamo detainees began to be released from the prison in large numbers, McClatchy newspaper set out to track down and talk to as many of the former prisoners as they could to determine who they were, what had happened to them since they were released. Reporters Tom Lasseter and Matthew Schofield interviewed 66 of them. Matthew Schofield is with us today, along with McClatchy foreign editor Roy Guttman. If you'd like to know how they got that story, what Matthew Schofield asked the detainees, and how Roy Guttman verified what they said, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Sierra. Sierra with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Yeah, just had a quick question listening to them. From everything I've read on the news, it seems like the United States is doing practically anything it can to piss people off. When you interviewed these people, did they have anything that they identified as the redeeming qualities of the United States? I mean, I know there's a lot of foreigners who look at the United States and say it was founded with great ideals and we're just not living up to them at the moment, but how do they feel, especially after what they've been through?
Matthew Schofield?
Yeah, almost all of these people before they were taken maintained, at least to us, that they had been very pro-United States. At this time, they would have no interest in visiting the United States because they're very worried about Homeland Security and just passing into the nation. I mean, they see a lot of good in the United States. They just didn't see it practiced with them. There's an intense amount of bitterness. And I'm trying to think of – there were a couple who still thought, you know, someday they'd actually like to end up in the United States. A number of the people I was talking to were the very, very poor people who just were trying to make a way in life. And among the very poor on earth, it's always – more important of the idea, can I find a way to make a living than perhaps the how will they treat me when I get there? So I mean they weren't willing to dismiss the United States as a destination completely, but yeah, no, there's a lot of bitterness, an intense amount of bitterness against what happened in the United States. A number of the people I talked to have been tortured in other places as well before. One Egyptian had had quite a bit of trouble in the past. So,
Thank you very much for the call, Sierra. One of the points of one of your stories is, in fact, that some of these people who had were either common criminals, thugs, if you will, when they were picked up, and have now been transformed into Taliban fighters or supporters of Al Qaeda. Roy Gutman.
Well, this is one of the most terrible aspects of the whole detention saga. The people who were taken to Guantanamo, as I say, on the whole, you know, in our list of 66, we found seven men, Afghans, who had been working for the Afghan government, which is supported by and supports the United States. And so these are totally the wrong men. In other cases, they scooped up shepherds. They found local thugs and, people who went around with guns and terrorizing the neighborhood and who had really, though, nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. They took them to places like Bagram and Kandahar where the mistreatment was really routine and it was terrible. I mean, they were hanging people from iron grates at the top of their cells for day in, day out at Bagram. And then to Guantanamo, where they're held indefinitely without charges or really any access to any form of due process. And there were some nasty types, and there are probably some nasty types at Guantanamo. These are the people who, in a sense, took over the prison by virtue of the fact that they were determined, motivated, and trained. And so the fairly innocent people, or the people who really didn't have a case against them, got radicalized. Now, we don't have that many cases of it, but we have several. And we know from the, even from the authorities at Guantanamo, that the inmates there set up a shura, or a kind of a council, an Islamic council. They issued fatwas, that's to say religious edicts on what detainees could do and could not do. They organized attempts at suicide. They organized food strikes. In other words, there was like, in fact, somebody, one of the commanders said it at Guantanamo, this is in our story, he said there was basically an Al-Qaeda cell set up at Guantanamo.
Which is extraordinary. And there are stories of in your one of the great controversies has been how many, if any, of the people released from Guantanamo Bay returned to the battlefield. And what you're suggesting is some of them may have turned to the battlefield for the first time. But how do you know, in fact, whether they were bad guys from the beginning and did return to the battlefield, or whether they were transformed by their experience at Guantanamo?
Look, every one of them is a different case, and that was so interesting in the whole project, and that's why we actually ran profiles, and they're on the web, on the McClatchy DC website. Some of the profiles go to 2,000 words because we really wanted to understand who these people are. I don't think we can say with precision just how many people moved from being, say, flirting with radicalism into full-fledged radicalism. But it was quite a number. And but the bottom line is this, Neil. If you're going to take in prisoners of war, and if you don't want to use the Geneva Conventions to determine, because there is a system under the conventions that you would determine who you have. Is this person actually a fighter? Was he involved in conflict? Did he attack your men? Did he commit crimes? You can actually do that on the battlefield. The administration dispensed with all of this.
They don't wear uniforms. You're going to check them against the Al-Qaeda recruitment logs?
There are ways that smart and military intelligence guys can figure out just who they've got. But you can't dispense with that altogether. And if you're going to take people in, you've got to differentiate between the people you're taking. And, only one-third of the 66 men we talked to were actually detained in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. All the rest were taken in the 2 or 3 years after that. Mm. And so if you don't have a system like that, then you're going to get the wrong guys, and then God knows where you go from there.
Here's an email question from Matt. If the former detainees were thought to be of little threat and release, how come their home countries apparently have not taken some of those people back? Matthew Schofield, you talked to people from China, Uyghurs in Albania. How come they're not back home in China?
The Chinese and the Uyghurs have a long history of not getting along. China kind of turns a blind eye to Uyghurs who sneak across the border as long as they don't come back. These guys are very much afraid. It's against the I guess it's against the Geneva Convention or it's against the UN rules of release. I'm skipping here. But if you release them to China, the belief is that they will be jailed and tortured again because of anti-Chinese beliefs. These guys, who the men I've talked to, they do not for a second deny that they have very strong anti-Chinese government feelings. They just say the idea of an anti-American feeling had never entered their mind before they were arrested. And so China really wasn't an option. These are people who had fled China. I'm talking about the Uyghurs here specifically. These are people who had fled China and had ended up in Albania because the United States couldn't find any place else to dump them. Now, in Albania, they are free to walk the city. There are no restrictions. There are no security restrictions on them whatsoever. There was another man who had fled Algeria because of a very personal issue, and he wouldn't return because it was a personal family issue. He just never wanted to return to Algeria. Other than that, the people I talked to were returning to their countries, I think. I'm pretty sure that's the case. There's an Egyptian who couldn't return because he'd had problems in Egypt before.
There's a question here at the microphone at the museum.
Yeah, I'm Nancy Borks from Virginia. And my question is, did any stop speaking to you or refuse to speak to you?
Well, Roy Gutman, why don't you ask the first part of that? Because obviously Mr. Lasseter did a lot of these interviews.
I think when Tom, it took a while to develop a system for even sitting down and talking to people and getting them to talk. And then one person often would lead to another, and you'd wind up actually finding a group of people as a result. What we found was quite a few, at least 13 of the 66, I think, would not be photographed or recorded. In one case, maybe Abbottabad, Pakistan, he went to meet a former detainee, and before they could talk, they were in a hotel room, the guy got up on a chair and he disabled the alarm system, the smoke alarm system, because he was afraid that there was a microphone there. These guys were very worried that the national police or intelligence operations were monitoring them, and, this guy, I think, told Tom, okay, it's over after about 2 hours. I can't say another word.
Mm. And Matthew Schofield, what about your experience? Were there people who refused to talk to you? Were there people who said
after a while? Yeah, there were quite a few people who refused to talk to me. The people who refused to talk to me, however, are not among the profiles. They refused to talk to me, so I couldn't get enough information about them to write a profile. There was one man. There are 8 detainees in Albania. We talked to 7. The Tipton 3, I was able to talk to Rol Ahmad, but I was not able to talk to the other 2. We had a conversation. I had a conversation with them, and they said, "Listen, they were very wary of another American journalist coming through, and so they appointed Rol as the spokesman for the Tipton 3. There are a couple other cases like this. There was a Spanish former detainee who was currently, at the time at least, was in jail in Spain. He wouldn't talk with us.
We had a problem also with Saudi Arabia, just getting the permission. And he sent a female reporter there, and these guys were fairly macho, I guess. She was able to talk to one, but only partially, and we weren't happy with that. We really did set out to interview everybody we could. The fact that we only got 66 of the 500 is not simply because we couldn't have reached them, but also we realized when we had that number that it was a significant number, and we really had to stop at a certain point.
Let's get Bob on the line. Bob is with us from Richmond in California.
Yes. Well, first of all, I've heard from the court filing, the Supreme Court filing, it's 30 of them returned from Guantanamo Bay to the field, and some of them blew up allies and U.S. personnel, etc. But I'm wondering, did any of these 66 admit to being part of the jihad prior to being picked up? Because if not a single one of them did, then you know they're lying to you, most of them. And it's a process called, a concept called taqiyya. Are you aware of it, where it's a Quranic injunction to lie to the infidel? And I think you've been naive if you've been duped that way.
Right.
Well, that's why I would urge you to look at the profiles on our website. It's mcclatchydc.com, because quite a number of them, in fact, said that they had been through training camps. One of them said he had seen Osama bin Laden. One of them told us that he actually had had some conversations with bin Laden, but he lied to the Americans at Guantanamo because he felt it was just going to lead to more beatings.
They were actually part of the jihad.
I'm not sure quite whether being part of the jihad itself is a phrase that we used in our questioning. We were interested to know whether they had been through the camps, whether they were part of Al Qaeda. Excuse me,
Rob, give him an answer. Give him a chance to answer. Just a moment.
I'm sorry.
We were interested and to know whether there was any potential crime that they had committed. How did they get arrested? How were they treated? The interesting thing, though, as I said earlier, Rob, was that of the 66 people, maybe 45 of them, or maybe around that number, were not Arabs, had not been part of Al Qaeda, had been scooped up because one of the largest numbers of people at Guantanamo was Afghans, followed by Pakistanis, and these people did not go through. They had almost nothing to do with Al Qaeda. It was a huge misunderstanding by the American military to think that the Afghans and the Pakistanis were part of this of the 9/11 plot. Almost all the evidence is that they weren't. But I think we decided to put our cards on the table, frankly, to put all of our information to be as transparent as possible with you and the public. And so every profile of every person is on our website.
Rob, you wanted to follow up?
Why do you think that an unlawful enemy combatant has to have any official or unofficial quasi-cryptic tie to Al-Qaeda? I mean, why? They just have to be... take the Quran seriously, the injunction to defend other Muslims in jihad, and bingo, that's it. They get swept up, and they ought to be.
Well, it's a pretty broad description, don't you think,
necessarily...
Rob?
Pardon me?
It's a pretty broad description.
Well, I mean, why?
If they've done nothing, if that's just their belief, and they've not acted on it?
No, that they're. I said that they're involved in the jihad, but they're not connected to Al-Qaeda.
Rob, I told you earlier... 7 of the 66 people we found were Afghans who had been working for the Afghan government, which is pro-U.S. and which is supported by the United States. These were total mistakes. So, you start from there.
There'd be some mistakes, but, there was a military police female that talked on the radio yesterday out here, and she said that the general perception of the Guantanamo detainees was they hated America, they hated Americans, they spit on the American personnel guarding them, and they drew little diagrams in the sand making fun of the 9/11 attacks.
I guess the point that this project is making, and it's certainly that we found really through an empirical research, is that whoever they were, wherever they came from, the treatment that they got left them embittered. And I don't think that, and secondly, that we didn't know who we had because the administration dispensed with law, dispensed with this ability to differentiate between who they had.
Rob, thanks very much.
Well, and we also...
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Matthew Schofield, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just in addition to this, I mean, when you go through the Combat Status Review Tribunal, you find on a number of these cases extremely broad allegations, nothing specific dealing with any of these people, just, you were a member of Al-Qaeda. And when you talk to these guys about the questions that they were being asked again and again, and the questions are the same at the beginning of their incarceration as they are at the end, sometimes a period of 4 or 5 years. Roy's point earlier that they didn't know who they had, I think, was frequently the case. They didn't know who they had. They didn't really know why they had them. The people who were doing the questioning don't really know what they're even trying to get from these people after a while, because the information regarding them was so broad and so general and not specific. I mean, the number of people we found who were arrested in the midst of combat or in the midst of acting against the United States was nil.
And very briefly, Roy Gutman, what is the response from the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense to your findings?
We went to the Pentagon again and again and again with lists of questions to try to elaborate how this all happened and to discuss our findings and get the response. And there was really no response, just the usual boilerplate. We treat people well, and
the United States is not engaged in torture.
We're not engaged in torture. Yeah.
So that was it. No interviews, no No access?
No. When you ask for the Assistant Secretary of Defense, who's in charge of detainee affairs, her office, Sandra Hodgkins is her name, refers you to her predecessor in the job or to people who are no longer in the government.
Thanks very much for being with us, both of you. Roy Guttman, who you just heard from, the foreign editor at McClatchy Newspapers, and Matthew Schofield, formerly the European correspondent for McClatchy and now the deputy national editor for the Kansas City Star, with us from WDUQ in Pittsburgh. When we come back, we'll be talking about the pain of modernization in China. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.